Welcome back to The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeologic artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last episode, we heard about the disputations of Paris and Barcelona, which put Judaism itself on trial and put an end to the protection granted to Jews by the Doctrine of Witness. We took a brief detour to learn about the Jews of India, and then traveled back to Christian Spain, where the Black Death and a Castilian civil war left Jews more vulnerable than ever. Finally, we left off last week hearing about the waves of violent anti-Jewish pogroms that swept across Castile and Aragon in the late 14th and early 15th centuries, killing thousands. This week, we will pick up our story where we left off and witness the dramatic and horrifying conclusion to the anti-Jewish violence in Christian Spain. All of the forced conversion and anti-Jewish violence of the pogroms had cast the Jews of Spain in several different directions. About a third of the Jewish population had been murdered in the pogroms, leaving countless mourning family members. Another third had managed to remain Jewish in spite of the violence against them, with some having had to flee to Muslim Morocco and Algeria for safety. And a final third had been successfully converted to Christianity, a group who came to be known as the conversos. Most of the conversos had accepted baptism begrudgingly, still holding fast to many Jewish traditions. And as it turns out, whether or not you truly accepted your new faith, becoming Christian in the eyes of the church came with some significant perks. Because of the church doctrine that all Christians, no matter their background, had to be accepted and treated equally, all of a sudden the newly converted Jews had much more freedom than they had before. They could live where they wanted, take up any job, and were spared from the frequent pogroms set upon the Jews by radicalized Christians. What's more, as it turns out, no one was really checking too carefully, at least at first, as to how committed you were to the Christian faith. So many conversos found ways to retain much of their Jewish connection, even after their baptisms. These included donating money to the Jewish kehillah, fasting on Jewish fast days, covertly lighting Shabbat candles on Friday nights, smuggling Jewish books like Haggadot and Sidurim into their homes, and teaching their children to memorize important Jewish prayers, like the Shema. Many Jews also held their connection to their mother religion with their taste buds. Oil-fried food at that time was a distinctively Jewish culinary style, and there were certain distinctly Jewish dishes, such as adafina or hamim, a pot stew full of beans, chickpeas, vegetables, and meat that would be simmered on the stove overnight so Jews would not have to light a spark on Saturday and break Shabbat. Some conversos, particularly by virtue of their high rates of literacy in multiple languages and high educational attainment, were able to achieve quite high status, especially during the reign of Alvaro de Luna, the Grand Constable of the Kingdom of Castile and de facto ruler of the kingdom, during the reign of the young, weak King Juan II. De Luna was a great friend of the conversos and appointed a number of them to high-ranking positions in the kingdom. Abraham de Benaviste, the head of the Castilian Jewish community, became chief tax collector. Diego de Vila handled the kingdom's finances, and Juan Alfonso de Baena was the king's private secretary. As some conversos became more and more powerful, especially given their ongoing commitment to Judaism, the surrounding Christians started to become increasingly bitter towards them. But there were other conversos who took their conversion to an extreme, fully committing to the new religion of Christianity, and often becoming some of the most zealous Christian proselytizers. Notable examples include Rabbi Solomon Halevi, who, upon his conversion, was renamed Pablo de Santa Maria. He rose to become the Bishop of Burgos and eventually the Chancellor of the entire Kingdom of Castile. Another converted Jew, Joshua Halorki, renamed Geronimo de Santa Fe, became the physician to the Pope and an evangelical priest. By the early 15th century, although the Kingdom of Castile was politically stable, the neighboring Kingdom of Aragon still lacked a strong ruler, leaving it open to the influence of radicals. And so, just as Ferrand Martinez had a decade earlier, another fanatical preacher went on to use the situation to his advantage. This time, the man's name was Vincent Ferrer, a Dominican friar hailing from the city of Valencia, who in the early 15th century had set off on a tour across Europe, preaching and attempting to convert Jews across the continent. Ferrer was nothing less than a fanatic and had some truly barbaric methods. He would travel from town to town with a large group of missionaries, who would march through the streets carrying torches and thick knotted ropes with which they would whip themselves until they bled. Ferrer, leading the charge, would carry a cross in one hand and a Torah scroll in the other. In every town they visited, Ferrer and his gang would round up every Jew over the age of 12 and force them into a synagogue to listen to him preach. He and his gang became so feared that many Jews, hearing that Ferrer was on the way, would flee their towns, hiding out in the nearby mountains or woods until he passed by. So when Ferrer returned to his home kingdom of Aragon in the 1410s to find it leaderless, he saw an opportunity to take control of the situation. Enrique III, the young king under whom Ferrer Martinez's pogroms had initially begun, had died in 1406, leaving no clear successor. To sort things out, the Aragonese courts decided to elect a panel of judges to appoint the next king, and they chose Ferrer as one of them. Ferrer, being a career preacher, was easily able to convince the other judges to back his own first choice for king, a young soldier named Ferdinand I, who was at that moment engaged in battle in Granada against the Muslims. But while Ferdinand was making his way home from the battlefront in Granada, Ferrer was left with significant power, and he used it to enact a number of anti-Jewish laws. Ferrer's laws essentially aimed to create a complete separation between Jews and the rest of society, both physically and socially. First and foremost, he restricted Jewish movement, corralling Jews into ghettos called juderías. Jews were banned from a great number of professions, including any public office, law, tax collection, medicine, hairdressing, surgery, or property management. Christians and Jews were forbidden to interact in any way. This meant no dining together, no visiting each other sick, and no speaking to one another. Jews were also forced to alter their appearance so they would be easily identifiable. They were forbidden from wearing any bright colors, nice fabrics, or expensive jewelry. They were forced to wear a special badge whenever they went out in public, and men were forbidden from trimming their beards, leaving them long and ragged. And of course, Jewish observance was strictly forbidden. Fortunately, the broad and sweeping nature of these laws also made them extremely difficult to enforce, and before most of them could be enacted, King Ferdinand returned to Aragon and revoked many of them. Things in Aragon once again settled briefly, but in 1435, another false rumor was conjured up in the city of Palma, a story about a Muslim having been crucified by local Jews. This charge prompted a trial, during which a group of Jews were tortured into a false confession and then burned alive. Seeing these innocent Jewish bodies burned understandably freaked out most of Palma's Jewish community, and many fled to the nearby mountain caves, where they had little food or supplies and were preyed on by bandits. Before long, the Jews were hunted down and dragged back to Palma, where they were forcibly converted to Christianity. Every Torah in the city was burned, the synagogue doors locked, and all of the shul's precious items were transferred to the nearby Christian cathedral. After this tragedy, Judaism was essentially lost from Majorca, only living on in the secret lives of those conversos who continued to practice. With these brutal pogroms becoming more and more frequent, life was becoming incredibly dangerous, if not outright impossible, for the Jews of Christian Spain. But so far, the violence had largely spared the conversos, who were viewed by the church as true Christians, and so were able to live relatively unmolested. But as the decades wore on, Christians began to wonder whether conversos could truly be considered Christian, if they still held to any of their old Jewish practices or culture. Just like the smallest ice crystal grows to become a snowball, these concerns rapidly grew, and would ultimately lead to unspeakable tragedy. In 1449, Alvaro de Luna, the constable of Castile who had been a friend to both Jews and conversos, traveled to Toledo to announce the introduction of a new tax. Well, no one likes taxes, and the citizens of Toledo didn't have to look far to find someone to blame. With their history of fierce anti-Semitism, and knowing de Luna to be a Jewish and converso sympathizer, the Christians of Toledo blamed the Jews, and stormed and ransacked not only the Jewish quarter of Toledo, but also hundreds of converso homes. This was the first open attack on conversos in Spanish history, and, just a few months later, Toledo's governor issued a law that would legally discriminate against Jews, not just based on religion, but based on blood. The law was known as the Limpieza de Sangre, or Purity of Blood Law, and it banned anyone with Jewish blood, including conversos, from holding any public office in Toledo. I will read the law to you verbatim. "We declare the so-called conversos, the offspring of perverse Jewish ancestors, to be held by law as infamous and ignominious and unfit to hold any public office in the city of Toledo or to have any authority whatsoever over true Christians." Although this law was quickly disavowed by Pope Nicholas V, it was becoming clear that the rapidly rising anti-Jewish fervor spreading like wildfire across the Iberian Peninsula was becoming increasingly difficult for the papacy to control. While Jews were becoming increasingly persecuted throughout Christian Spain, a new empire was pushing outward from Eastern Europe, challenging the growing Christian empire's supremacy. They were known as the Ottomans, named after their founder, Osman I, and were actually an offshoot of the Seljuk Turks, whom we learned about earlier this season. The Ottomans had started their conquests in the year 1300, and by the year 1450 had amassed a good deal of territory, controlling an area from Serbia, Kosovo, and North Macedonia all the way to the middle of modern-day Turkey. In 1453, the Ottomans made a major play and conquered the city of Constantinople, the crown jewel of the Byzantine Empire and a critically important city to the church. This military victory was viewed as a major threat to all of Christianity and prompted Pope Calixtus III to launch a brand new crusade with the aim to push the Ottomans back out of Christian territory. Unsurprisingly, as crusades tended to do, Christian Europe was whipped into an even more fervent frenzy, which led to some disastrous consequences for the Jews. In the wake of this new crusade against the Ottomans, a new idea was finding popularity among Christians in Spain. It was popularized in a 1461 book called Fortalitum Fide, or Fortress of Faith, written by a Franciscan friar named Alonso de Espina. In his book, de Espina contends that in order for the second coming of Jesus to occur, all of Christendom had to be purged of non-believers. This idea found its origins in the Council of Clermont centuries earlier, when the Pope had sanctioned the idea of holy war against the Muslims, sparking the First Crusade. However, de Espina took this idea even further, insisting that conversion of non-believers to Christianity was not enough to satisfy the Second Coming, since converts could always stray back to their old ways. And so, both in his book and on his preaching missions throughout Castile and Aragon, he suggested an alternative solution, a Spanish Inquisition. Let me just take a pause here, because I'm sure that the Spanish Inquisition as a concept is familiar to many of you, even if only from the famous Monty Python sketch. But before diving into this dark chapter of Jewish history, it is worth taking just a brief moment to understand what an Inquisition actually was. The idea of an Inquisition was fairly new at the time. It had been invented by Christian judicial scholars of the 11th century as a way of prosecuting offenses that were of little consequence to the crown, but were felt to be threats or violations against the church. For the most part, these were ideological sins, things like heresy or dissent against church doctrine. The process of an Inquisition differed in a few key ways from usual civil trials of the time. In a typical civil legal case in Middle Age Spain, someone with an axe to grind would bring his case before a judge, and it would go to trial, during which both the complainant and accused would call their own witnesses and hire legal representatives to help them argue their case. At the end of the day, if the accuser won, the accused would be punished. But if the accused was found innocent, it would be up to the accuser to bear the cost and consequences of the trial. In an Inquisition, however, the accuser was often a public officer, usually a member of the church, as was the judge. Furthermore, if the accused was found innocent, the accuser would face no penalty for having made the accusation in the first place. This meant that there was very little to deter someone from making an accusation, and that the trial itself was often heavily biased toward a guilty verdict for the accused. The Inquisitions also tended to cause some friction between the church and the crown, since the crown was often hesitant to bestow that degree of power upon the church. Because of this, at least prior to the 15th century, Inquisitions were relatively rare, and were typically one-off events, assembled to deal with a very particular issue, such as the trial of Joan of Arc in 1431. De Espina's idea of an inquisition against the Jews and conversos actually found favor with the Castilian king for a brief moment, and in 1461, Pope Pius II gave formal authorization for an inquisition to be launched. Fortunately, though, King Enrique changed his mind not long afterwards, and the idea went into hibernation for over a decade, until a change in leadership suddenly revived it. This change in leadership came in the form of a marriage between Ferdinand V, King of Sicily and next in line to the throne of Aragon, and the young princess of Castile named Isabella. Isabella had been separated from her mother when she was just a girl, sent with her brother Alfonso to Madrid to live with the Castilian royal family. Alfonso happened to be the half-brother of the King of Castile, Henry IV, who, having no children, planned to leave the throne to Alfonso once he died. The king paid little attention to Isabella, though, and she found herself largely alone in Madrid, without a parental figure. The person who ended up taking on the role of parent, teacher, and mentor to Isabella was a quite zealous and somewhat fanatical Dominican priest named Tomás de Torquemada. Through his tutelage, Isabella grew to become a strict Catholic as well, and adopted many of her mentor's extreme views, including the view that Spain should be unified under Catholicism and purged of any false Christians. In October of 1469, at the age of 18, Isabella married Ferdinand, unifying the formerly independent kingdoms of Aragon, Castile, and Sicily for the first time in decades. And, given the militant political and religious views that had been instilled in Isabella by Torquemada, the idea of a converso inquisition gained new life. With some convincing from Torquemada, Isabella and Ferdinand approved the inquisition, and in 1478 they received official authorization from Pope Sixtus IV to begin. The Inquisition formally got going in the year 1480 in the city of Seville. Similar to the Crusades that preceded it, the early days of the Inquisition were fairly haphazard, and due to the religious fervor already rampant throughout Castile, things quickly spiraled out of control. The inquisitors encouraged the citizens of Seville to come forward with accusations against any converso who they suspected of holding secret Jewish beliefs, no proof required. Once accused, victims were arrested and thrown in jail, then starved and tortured, sometimes for years, into making a confession. No amount of denying would help. The torture would continue endlessly until a confession was made. The methods of torture used by the inquisitors were numerous and horrific. They included the rack on which the accused was tied up and their body slowly stretched out until their joints popped. Foot roasting, in which the accused's feet were covered in animal fat and then literally roasted over a fire. And the Judas cradle, a tall, thin stool with a spiked seat on which the accused was slowly impaled. Once a confession was finally extracted, the victim would be slated to appear at a public trial called an auto de fe, during which inquisitors would sit as judge and jury before the victim. During these spectacles, the accused was dressed in an outfit known as the San Benito, or Garment of Shame. It included a large pointy hat and white robe with the cross of St. Andrew embroidered upon it. The accused conversos would be marched through the crowd and up onto a stage, upon which they were found either innocent or guilty by the Inquisition. If found innocent, they were forced to thank their torturers before being whipped and having their property confiscated. If found guilty, they were burnt at the stake in front of a jeering crowd. By the end of the Inquisition's first year, the Jewish death toll had reached 700 in Seville alone. The Inquisitor's haphazard system of hearing accusations from any corner meant that, soon, even respected members of local churches, priests and clergymen, were being accused of being secret Jews and tortured. It was only once the violence began to affect church leaders that Pope Sixtus began to get uncomfortable. So he wrote to Isabella and Ferdinand, suggesting that they do something to curb the aggressive and unregulated tactics of the inquisitors. Queen Isabella agreed that things were getting a little out of hand, and so she and the Pope agreed to appoint a special official to oversee the entire Inquisition. To fill the position, Isabella turned to her closest mentor, the militant Catholic priest Tomás de Torquemada. In 1483, Torquemada accepted the role, and got to work with great vigor. As one of his first moves as Grand Inquisitor, he fired many of the original inquisitors in Seville, and instead hired his own men, who he knew would be faithful and obedient to him. Torquemada then moved on to tackle a second problem the Inquisition had created. The Spanish jails were overflowing with accused conversos, who were sometimes held in prison for months or years pending a confession. To alleviate this strain, and to save the crown some much-needed money, Torquemada had makeshift jails called casillas built on the outskirts of the cities to house extra inmates. In order to standardize the inquisitorial process, he published an official inquisitor's code with 28 separate articles outlining the proper conduct of an inquisitor. According to his code, published in November of 1484, when inquisitors first arrived in a town, they were to publicly pronounce an edict of grace, which gave any conversos who wished to confess to Judaizing 30 days in which to do so. If they came forward during that time, they would be spared from death, though would still be subject to significant punishment, including having their property confiscated and being forbidden from accessing public services, riding a horse, or carrying a weapon. Whoever didn't come forward during this 30-day window was officially eligible to be accused. Essentially, anyone could accuse you of being a secret Jew, based on essentially anything: cooking your meals for the weekend on a Friday night, buying goods from a Jewish vendor, or refusing pork at a dinner party. As long as there were two witnesses willing to sign on to the accusation, you were rounded up and arrested. Within 3 days of the arrest, the accused would have a hearing before a member of the inquisitorial squad. If they refused to confess, they were locked up again, and the torture began. Torquemada insisted that a doctor be present at all torturing sessions, but this was mostly just to ensure that the accused didn't die prematurely during the course of the torture. Torquemada also introduced a new method of torture. He called it the water cure, and it involved placing a cloth over the face of the victim and then pouring water over top of it, essentially the first waterboarding. The accused would sometimes be held in prison for months, continuously being tortured to produce a confession. Eventually, the imprisoned conversos were forced to appear at the auto-da-fé, and either found innocent and released, or found guilty and burned alive. The result of this new structure of justice was that Spain rapidly became a surveillance state. People began to mistrust their neighbors, and were constantly afraid that an inquisitor would come knocking and throw them in jail. People also started to keep a very close watch on their neighbors, creating a classic prisoner's dilemma, a giant game of chicken for who would rat on the other first. To make matters worse, over time, Torquemada expanded the Inquisition, not just geographically to include all of Spain, but also to include other sins against the church, like sorcery, polygamy, sodomy, and blasphemy. Although the Inquisition sent the vast majority of Jews into a panic, there were some who attempted to fight back. Rabbi Isaac Abravanel, a friend of both Ferdinand and Isabella, had approached the royal couple early on, making a handshake deal that in return for the Jewish community helping to finance the Reconquista, they would be kept safe. Unfortunately, this deal was not honored. Abraham Señor, a Jew who was on good terms with both King Ferdinand and Torquemada, also pled with the couple to put a stop to the Inquisition, but to no avail. Things got so desperate that in Saragossa, a group of conversos, fearing for their lives and the lives of their families, plotted to murder one of the head inquisitors there. They nearly succeeded, but were caught in the act and were captured, tortured, and killed by the inquisitors. By the year 1490, despite having burned nearly 2,000 conversos at the stake and tortured many thousands more, Torquemada was unsatisfied. No matter how many conversos he rooted out, he was constantly finding more, and he could tell that the Inquisition was not getting at the root of the problem. Spain had still not been purified. He began to feel that the true problem lay with the fact that there were still practicing Jews in Spain, and, until they were completely removed, Catholicism would always be under threat. And so, he began to petition the king and queen to permanently expel all Jews from Spain. The idea of expelling the Jews posed two problems, however. The first was that expelling an entire group of people from their territory, even a group as hated as the Jews, would not exactly have the best optics. Second, and more important, the Jews were still important economic contributors to the kingdom, and Christian Spain was in the thick of battle with the Muslim state of Granada in the south, attempting to complete the Reconquista once and for all. But in 1491, with a Christian army of 12,000 men closing in, the King of Granada finally surrendered, giving up the last Muslim holdout in the Iberian Peninsula to the Christians. With the Reconquista finally complete, the economic calculus had changed, and the kingdom could finally afford to rid itself of the Jews. To deal with the optics issue, all they needed was an excuse, and Torquemada handed them one on a silver platter. He spread a false story through the kingdom that a Christian child had been abducted from Toledo, crucified by Jews, and then taken to a mountain cave, where his heart was cut out to use in black magic. This completely invented story caused an absolute uproar in the already fanatical atmosphere of inquisitorial Spain, and gave Ferdinand and Isabella the reason they needed to officially order the expulsion of all Jews from the kingdom on the 31st of March, 1492. Not only was this now optically acceptable, but the king and queen realized that the money they would make by confiscating Jewish property and annulling all of the debts owed to Jewish debt collectors would make the expulsion more than worth their while. As per the expulsion order, by the 1st of July, 1492, all Jews had to be gone from the kingdom. This date happened to be particularly significant to the Jews, as it fell on the Jewish fast day of Tisha B'Av, the same day of the Jewish calendar on which the Second Temple was destroyed. The fleeing Jews were forced to leave the kingdom on foot, and could only bring with them whatever they could carry on their backs. They were forbidden from taking any money, valuables, gold, or silver with them, and were forced to leave their mules and horses behind. Not only was this meant to humiliate the Jews, but it was also meant to retain as much wealth as possible within Spain, maximizing the profitability of the expulsion. If any Jew was to be found in Spain after the 1st of July, they were to be killed. Ultimately, more than 160,000 Jews were expelled from Spain, and around 40,000 decided to stay and convert wholeheartedly to Christianity. As the Jews and conversos fled, their homes and any Jewish books they left behind were pillaged and burned by their neighbors, and they were often attacked and burgled on the road for what little possessions they had managed to take with them. Many fled to ports on the coast, where they had to drive hard bargains with ship captains to allow them to board as refugees. Many were killed at sea as they attempted to flee from their certain death on land. A priest historian of the day, Andrés Bernaldez, wrote about what he witnessed as the Jews of Spain were exiled. Quote, "They went along the roads and over the fields, in much travail and misfortune, some falling, others standing up, some dying, others being born, others still falling sick, and there was not a Christian who did not feel sorrow for them, and wherever they went, the Christians beseeched them to be baptized, and some, in their misery, would convert and remain. But few, very few, did so, and the rabbis continually gave them strength and bade the women and girls sing and play tambourines and timbrels to raise the people's spirits." Unquote. Although the Jews and conversos were almost entirely wiped out of Spain by 1493, the Inquisition continued for centuries, going on to target Muslims, Moriscos, Muslim converts to Christianity, and then Protestants and Roman Catholics, and spreading its reach throughout Italy and into the Spanish colonies of Peru and even Mexico. It was not until 1834 that the Spanish Inquisition was formally abolished. Although I did not explore it in depth this week, there was also a Portuguese Inquisition, which got started in 1547 and continued until 1821. The expulsion of Jews from England, France, Spain, and Portugal represented the most significant event of ethnic cleansing in Jewish history and would go on to fundamentally alter Jewish history going forward. It is here that we will end Season 3. In Season 4, we will explore what the Jews would make of their new lives post-expulsion. Stay tuned. That's all coming up next season on The Jewish Story.